Welcome, everyone, to Midday Magazine for this April 11th, 2024. Have your host, James J. Maloff, here. We're joined right now by our good friend, UW Extension Ag Agent Matt Lippert is with us. Matt, always good to see you.
Good to see you.
Thanks for being here. Appreciate the time. I want to get into a couple of things with you, whatever we have time for today, Matt. But one of the things that I came across was the wet start to the Wisconsin 24 growing season. And I got this article from WisconsinAgConnection.com. If you're curious to check out the whole article, WisconsinAgConnection.org. I know Pam was kind of talking your ear off a little bit, too, like I was, about this crazy weather season we've had and how this might affect our ag industry and our farmers out there.
So I think what was most unusual, what you're referring to, is our non-winter that we had.
Yeah.
Most people prefer a little less winter-like conditions.
Sure.
So we didn't have much snow to push. We didn't have extreme temperature. Sometimes we're worried about if there's no snow, that then it gets cold, and then we have the soil temperature gets really cold, and we can have some damage to plant crowns, plant roots. I think we're starting to know a little bit already that we didn't have much problem that way. I'm a little intrigued by your article, a wet beginning to the season, because, you know, we had a drought all of last year, one of the most severe we've had in probably like 20 years. Then we got into October, and depending where you were, we got like 8 to 11 inches of rain in the last 2 weeks of October, which actually, you know, that sounds like too much too quick, but it was so dry that I think we captured a lot of that. But then there is a lot of concern through the winter without the snow, being previously dry, that it was dry. We were concerned about El Nino is supposed to be switching to La Nina. Mm-hmm. That's supposed to... actually, La Nina, does the maps I've seen, don't have as dramatic impacts on the upper Midwest as some other areas. But
yeah.
So actually, the little bit of, I wouldn't call it a wet spring yet. And as far as in southern Wisconsin, it's April, maybe even into March, they will do some planting of some crops. But we usually in this area, I was even talking to potato growers last week, you know, they're just starting, they're right on schedule. The people on the heavier soil have done some spring tillage that's way ahead of normal. So it wouldn't have been, we locally here would not call it a wet spring.
Sure. Yeah.
But now that it is starting to get to be closer to more legitimate time to do it, we're back to a more normal situation that there is moisture in some situations in the field, and we can't just go out and do everything. But that's really normal. I wouldn't call this a wet spring.
Hmm. So with that being said, is there, with the season we've had, as consumers, are we going to be seeing some effects from this, or are we going to even notice?
At this point, I don't think there's anything that would be noticeable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As I said, it's very early in the season.
Right. Yeah. Very hard to tell. And I hate making you look in your crystal ball. I don't like doing that to you, but especially with this industry. But it is something that I think that we, a lot of people, I should say, when we're talking weather, like we all do from people with making small talk and that, one of the things that would come up was the concern of that. And it was actually kind of reassuring to me in just the sense of, oh, people are thinking of this. People are thinking of farmers. People are thinking of, now maybe they're thinking of it in part because of how it affects them personally. Mm-hmm. But at the very, you know, it's building on this empathy that not only you and I, but I think a lot of people in this state really try to create of getting people to understand what it is to be a farmer and having some empathy for that.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a little bit of that comes from this conversation that is good. But it's interesting to see that, you know, not that we know right now, of course, but how this weather affects, of course, where things
go. So one thing that is maybe a little weather related is people have noticed in the stores that beef has gotten really high priced. We have the smallest cattle herd, so that's dairy and beef together, since I think it's like 1951 or 1953, and a little of that is how we've gotten more efficient, but it's noticeable. We have a really small, we don't have many mother beef cows making baby animals that are going to turn into meat in the grocery store.
Mm.
And there's other factors, but one of the main ones is it has been dry. on the areas. The beef industry, you hear about feedlots where these animals get finished on a high grain diet to get the marbling in their meat. But the typical beef production in the U.S. starts out on pastures with cows that live on pastures all their lives. And they, in the spring, this time of year, they're dropping calves, and the calves nurse on their mothers, and then those calves stay out in the pasture, the range, whichever you want to call it, and then later in life they get finished. Well, the range areas in the southern U.S., southern Midwest, plains have been dry, and there's not been feed. So there's maybe other factors, but there's just not many cows around, and I think that would be a weather-related thing.
Matt, since we're talking cows a little bit here, and I don't have my youngest daughter around to talk cows because she loves cows. That's her favorite animal. I did want to get into a subject that Melissa and I in our morning show were talking about, and it comes to us actually from your neck of the woods in UW Extension, and encourage people to find more great articles at the University of Wisconsin's website, news.wisc.edu. The headline was, cows are getting sick in other states. What does it mean for Wisconsin? Can we touch on this topic for a little bit?
Sure.
Where for you, when you first hear this news, what was the first news? How did this hit you? How did this impact?
Well, there's a Texas Panhandle is actually an area where there's actually quite a few large dairies now, and it started there. The first news was we have these cows that are getting very sick, very few mortalities, but just suddenness of stopping eating, temperatures. And these are large dairies where they actually have monitors where they can tell the cow's stomach, her rumen, how it's functioning. And it's just like immediate cessation, you know, just nothing. And they didn't know what it was from. And it took probably over a week before they said, well, this is bird flu. And so it's called highly pathogenic avian bird influenza flu. And so we haven't had this in the cattle. We've had it when we've had some egg shortages in the last couple of years. This has been HPAI as well. So it has jumped species. And it's actually been kind of quiet, I'd say, the last week. So we found it in Texas. Then it was in Idaho and Kansas. Then it was in Michigan. And so I'd say still it would seem highly probable that this is going to spread because it's shown up in all these places. So it can spread cow to cow. It can spread from the wild birds, which are hard to control how that happens. And it has a unique presentation in that it's not affecting our young animals. It's affecting older animals. It's not affecting early lactation, which is actually a high production, high stress period, seems to be affecting later lactation. So it has a lot of, it presents, I don't know if they drink so little or whatever, but that they get dehydrated, but they present a thick, non-normal yellowish milk. So it's still evolving. It could be really major. The fact that we haven't had as much news and that we haven't had it reported here in Wisconsin yet, I think there's a little hope. It also is zoonotic, which means that we knew this before. People on chicken farms can carry, they can get bird flu. And it's usually, it's not like a COVID outbreak yet. Of course, because this thing is mutating, but people can get like pink eye sort of effect from it. And it's usually people that are directly working with the animals. So you cook meat, we pasteurize milk. You should not be too alarmed that oh, if I drink milk from cows from Texas that I'm going to get bird flu. You shouldn't be thinking that way because it's pasteurized and you cook your meat. So we're not too concerned about that at this point. But if it does continue to spread, we could have more production loss, and you'd be seeing that in the store if we have less milk.
From the article and from Keith Polson, University of Wisconsin Medicine expert in zoonotic disease and director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostics Laboratory, there are a couple of things that they wanted to stress from this article: that pasteurized milk and cooked meat, as Matt was saying, and all products are safe, and there is no reason to believe there is any concern for dairy products. The disease seems to be spreading from bird to cow, not cow to cow, though investigations are underway to determine how the disease was spread to the Michigan dairy. And at this time, the disease is not considered a high risk for public health. So it is important to note those things. We can do two things at once, though. I think that it's important to be able to chew gum and walk at the same time. It's important to know about this stuff. Nobody's trying to scare people, though. We're not trying to freak anybody out or anything.
Rightly so. I mean, people get scared.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So even if I tell them, don't worry, the milk is pasteurized, you cook your meat, there's thousands of people, millions of people. Mm. Some people are going to be alarmed, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So
we do a good job of freaking ourselves out. We don't always need the scientists to do it for us and right. Everything. Yeah. That's a good point. I do think, again, coming back to this, where while we don't have concerns necessarily for these things as far as consumers go, it is another reminder of how the diligent work that is done behind the scenes and stuff before we even see this food on our plate. And how much work goes into this with the ag industry and the scientists and everybody involved in the Food and Safety Administration to try to make sure that the products, once it lands on your plate, it is safe.
Well, so background research, this was very, I suppose it's 3 weeks ago now, very alarming. These cows are getting really sick and it seems to be spreading. So, and we don't know what it is. So, you know, there was a lot of state veterinarian departments in multiple states figuring out that this was this HPAI that we've mainly seen in poultry, had adapted to affect cattle. Mm. So there's a lot of work already that's been done on this. But our state veterinarian departments are incredible in the work that they do.
Yeah, it really is impressive. We're speaking with Matt Lippert, agricultural agent with UW Extension Madison. And Matt, one of the things that I want to send a shout out actually to our Wisconsin Rapid City Times as well, and some great reporting done by Gene and Mike and about our own little neck of the woods here. There's this wonderful place for connecting food and those who grow it. That is the mission statement of the new Food Plus Farm Exploration Center, located right off of I-39. In Plover. I wanted to talk about that facility a little bit and what it is, what it gives to the community and the future of what it could bring as far as maybe sparking young minds and to get into this industry, learning more about it, and that, again, coming back to the empathy thing, at the very least, creating more of a bridge of that. It sounds like a great facility.
It is an awesome facility. Hmm. I've been there once. I would recommend everyone should, I mean, it's just over in Plover, south side of Plover. It's brand new. It's state of the art. I've seen some other versions of this. So there was a lot of groups that came together to sponsor this. And you actually, I'm intrigued that you picked that one up. Maybe the newspaper wrote about that a little bit. But there's a concern about agriculture is really a prevalent industry in the central Wisconsin area. And a lot of people don't realize that, what I physically do is not, I don't get my hands dirty, I don't handle a crop mm-hmm. or an animal, but I do things that are serving agriculture. It could mm-hmm. be laboratory work, it could be accounting functions, it could be IT, because ag is getting more sophisticated. Mm-hmm. So there's a concern in ag that we don't have enough people realizing as they're choosing, because we know there's not as many young children. There's more people. The pyramid is the wrong way. That my age is leaving the workforce, and there's not as many people to replace it. So there's a concern about, will we have people that realize the great opportunities there are in agriculture? So I think that's one of the reasons to create this facility is there's a lot of things for families, mm-hmm. preschool, elementary school. There's since it's new, there's just the parking lot every day has got lots of buses from elementary schools. But there's things for every age group. It's very interactive, and it does a great job of educating about protecting the earth, conservation, water. practices that we use, areas that we're working on managing fertilizer. It's so there. I've seen others like this. There's one in the Fair Oaks area between Indianapolis and Chicago that's really famous for teaching people about dairy production and hog production. And you can go watch a cow calve, a live birth there. Mm-hmm. This one is dedicated a little more to our potato and vegetable production area in the irrigated Central Sands. But they have a great deal of information on when they water, the kind of sprinkler heads they use. I'm just touching on it. It's really a neat place, and I think everybody would find it interesting to see.
Yeah, there's a lot of detail that goes went into this, and so that you're going in and you're not just seeing a tractor. You're seeing, like Matt said, some of the details of that. You're getting a little bit more of the nuts and bolts of the conversation with this, and I really think that part is not the detail is going to help only more it stay in their hearts and their heads. This information for these kids, along with possibly sparking an interest in the field. I also appreciate you touching on the other aspects of ag that I personally don't think about all the time either, and I know some listeners might not either, about the accounting and some of these other things that just doesn't get covered very often. So I appreciate you touching on that. With something like this, Matt, I imagine that that it's a great thing to have, of course, and we're happy for it for all the reasons we've just said. Does it help at all when you've spent your life and dedicated so much to this industry to see things like this, to see efforts like this to help the industry? I imagine it goes some ways for you. It's not easy for our ag industry these days. And I imagine that it's got to be at least some gift or some, not gift, but some a good feeling to see such work being put into a project like this.
I think it's very nicely done. There's a concern sometimes in schools that teachers are probably starved for media. And so they want to teach about food production or ag. And they get a hold of, some alarmist material that implies that the main agricultural production system in the country is, I don't know, inhumane or doesn't respect workers or doesn't respect the environment. And it's a lot more nuanced than that,
yeah. You
know. And so I think this does a nice job of talking about alternatives. It talks about why you might want to use an organic food or an organic production system and what it does. On the other hand, it talks about how conventional systems, for many reasons, have to also be respectful of the environment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really nicely done. And I think it's whenever you put a lot of effort into education, you want to see it be balanced.
Yeah.
And I think it does that pretty well.
One of the other things that I noticed about this and reading in it was something that you mentioned something about what I was saying before about the importance of this, and you touched on that concern as well. And certainly they do a nice job in the article talking about that, but I picked that up in going to school out here, like working and working alongside kids that come from an ag family, and some of the concern there from their parents or from them themselves about their brother and sister or somebody continuing that work, continuing to stay in that field. I've seen that a lot, and one thing I've seen a lot of that is not only people that have questioned whether or not they want to go into that field, and then they ended up going into the field, but also people that have come back to the field. People have gone off and gone to school, come back to town, and this is, you know what, they found out, they read about other industries, but this is the one that they want and they want to be a part of. So it is interesting to see with that. And then there is the other part, and Matt, you and I have touched on this a bit before, and you really opened my eyes to this, along with Rachel Whitehair, who used to work there as well, about the tech and ag industry and how hand-in-hand those are and how much that's enhancing and making it that much better going forward for future generations. I just saw, doing some homework for our conversation here, I saw an article on new scarecrows, lasers that aim to deter wild birds. Like, we're even updated the scarecrow, Matt. Like, we don't even have traditional scarecrows anymore. Like, it's
a
pretty
laser.
Yeah. It's out of here.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting. It's pretty unique to see where this is going. I imagine that that's got to be enticing to the young generation. I think that that's got to be incentivize is the wrong word, but maybe give them even more encouragement of getting into this field. And it's kind of wild to see, I imagine, especially for you, somebody who's grown up in this industry.
Well, so a lot of people have left agriculture over the years out of concern of working outdoors, too many hours, too little pay, too much risk. And they watch their parents. So these are all real things. And I'm not saying that it's just a plush, easy life anymore. Yeah. But there's been a lot of things address those. Agriculture is essential. So we have to make it manageable for the people that work in it. You're talking about technology. I just had earlier this week on Tuesday, I had a program about robotic milking of cows.
Yeah.
So that is, we had 150 people there, and typically, and we didn't feed them a free meal. And usually in ag, because Extension doesn't feed free meals, usually some cooperative or something has a spring day and they feed people and they get a lot of people. But this, we didn't do any of that. We had 150 people at this farm. It was up near Abbotsford. And it's about robotics. So dairy producers have a lot of interest in robotic milking. So if you know, the Census of Agriculture recently came out, and most of the cows and most of the milk in the country these days are produced on farms over 2,000 cows, which we have very few of those around here, and we think that's this is a big dairy area. But these really big farms have a lot of cows, and so when you account for where the milk comes from, it comes from those big farms. So that's changed in agriculture a lot. But because of this cows and large farms, it's an incredible amount of the milk that is the people milking the cows are Hispanic. Hmm. And we hear all the fraught discussion about people crossing the border that tend to be Hispanic, Spanish-speaking people. And agriculture, dairy farmers need those workers, and you'll hear, well, the native white population doesn't want to milk cows. Hispanics don't necessarily want to milk cows. So we're finding that robots are becoming a really important alternative. And cows can like this too, because instead of going to the parlor to get milked when the farmer says twice or three times a day in a robotic milking system, the cow decides if she wants to get milked five times a day or twice a day.
Wow.
And the computer behind the robot, if this cow wants to go more often than the computer thinks it should, she's wasting the time of the computer, the gate is closed. The cow is not allowed to enter. But if she's a heavy producer at the time of her lactation, when it's very legitimate that she should want to get milk five times a day, it opens up the door and welcome. These are a pretty neat piece of equipment to see how an arm comes under the udder, and it's either like lasers or camera is identifying where the attachment should be made.
Crazy. That's amazing.
Yeah. So there's a lot of interest in these. They're quite expensive, but if you're hiring labor, it's a trade-off.
Right.
So they're actually popular amongst large dairies that are putting in dozens of these things, or smaller family-sized dairies that just want one or two of them.
Yeah. Matt, I look forward to talking again real soon and getting more into this and talking some more about these kind of subjects. Always appreciate the time and the insight from you, Matt. Thank you so much for it. We'll talk again real soon.
Very good.
Well, the more Midday Magazine for you coming up on WFHR, locally grown radio.